Yeah, that's why when people ask me where I work, I just say SAIC. Acronyms are, you know, we talk in acronyms now. So, it's a mouthful. I want to express my appreciation to the leadership of the of Jacksonville congregation here for allowing us to come and speak. The six of us who will be speaking in the course of the seminar certainly think that these topics are vitally important to the church right now. We really appreciate this forum. But most importantly, I appreciate all of you for being here, for taking the time to come, for your interest in this subject matter that we think is vitally important. You may not know who Ronald Pinkerton is. He's a hang glider that has described in Guidepost Magazine an experience that he had one time. If you don't know anything about hang gliding, these are guys that like to jump off of cliffs with big kites strapped to their backs. He described an incident that happened to him one time, and it's very interesting and applicable to the kinds of things that we're going to be talking about this evening. He took off and immediately was lifted up to about 4,200 feet, which, if you know your conversions, that's only 1,000 feet short of a mile straight up. So he was basically in a thermal column of air that lifted him up very quickly. But then he hit what we would call a microburst, you may have heard wind shear, and he began dropping altitude very quickly after that. And this is the way he describes this. I was falling at an alarming rate. Trapped in an airborne riptide, I was going to crash. Then I saw him, a red-tailed hawk. He was 6 feet off my right wingtip, fighting the same gust I was. I looked down the ground 300 feet. I looked down to the ground 300 feet from the ground and still falling. The trees below seemed like menacing pikes. I looked at the hawk again. Suddenly, he banked and flew straight downwind. Downwind? If the right air is anywhere, it's upwind. The hawk was committing suicide. 200 feet from nowhere, the thought entered my mind. Follow the hawk. It went against everything I knew about flying, but all my knowledge was useless. He was headed for the ground. There was not much else he could do. I was at the mercy of the wind. I turned and followed the hawk. 100 feet, only 100 feet above the ground. Suddenly, the hawk began to gain altitude. For a split second, I seemed to be suspended motionless in space. Then a warm surge of air started pushing the glider upward. I was stunned. Nothing I knew as a pilot could explain the phenomenon, but it was true. I was rising. So the hawk apparently knew something that Mr. Pinkerton and all his experience as a hang glider didn't know. And still, as he describes his experience after the fact, has no basis for describing what it was that happened to him. But clearly, the hawk knew something that he didn't. You may also not be familiar with Samuel Langley. If you've heard of NASA Langley Research Center in Virginia, it's named after him. Langley was an aeronautical researcher that was contemporary with the Wright brothers. He was working on powered aircraft research at the same time that they were. He makes a statement along similar lines. Now, he wasn't a hang glider, but he indicates that his motivation for wanting to study aerodynamics was watching birds. And he says that he used to watch the birds flying when he was a boy and wondered, you know, what kept them up in the air. It finally occurred to me there must be something in the condition of the air which the soaring birds instinctively understood, but we do not. Now, as an interesting note, Samuel Langley was not successful with his manned flights. He was actually the first researcher to build a powered aircraft. It was a small, he called it an aerodrome, sort of like our UAVs, Predators, and you see on TV today. But his were steam powered, and they actually flew. But when he tried to scale up that technology to carry human beings, it didn't work. And his last unsuccessful flight was 9 days before the Wright brothers flew their first aircraft at Kitty Hawk. So not successful from that perspective. Interesting side note there, Langley was funded by a government grant, and of course the Wright brothers were privately funded. So I'll leave it up to you to decide whether there's any importance in that. But he was unsuccessful, but yet he mentions birds as his primary motivation for wanting to study in this area. And of course, the Wright brothers, we understand, were interested in birds and flying insects as well. The words there are kind of small and hard to see, but this was an excerpt from the very first article that was ever written about the Wright brothers' designs and their flights. And it appeared in a magazine called Gleanings in Bee Culture. Amos Ives Root was an entomologist who specialized in honeybees, and he was a friend of the Wright brothers. So he wrote the first article. Interestingly enough, when they flew at Kitty Hawk, there weren't really any reporters there. There weren't any news reports. 9 days earlier, when Langley had his failure, he was launching his, by the way, off of boat platforms in the Potomac, and you know the flight pattern for his aircraft was sort of like this, right into the Potomac River. There were a lot of media there, but to record that failure. But for the Wright brothers, I mean, this was the first. This modest article was the first report of any of their activities. I like what Mr. Root says when he, in his last sentence there, where he calls the flying machine as God's most gracious and precious gift. And what he's referring there to is the fact that earlier in the article he pointed out that the Wright brothers were very keenly interested in birds and flying insects, and that's what motivated their research as well. And so he extrapolates that to, well, where did the birds and insects come from? And just naturally assumed, well, they were created by God. So basically the motivation for the Wright brothers was God's flying creatures. Wilbur Wright alludes to this in a letter that he wrote to Octave Chanute. He talks about being afflicted with the belief that flight is possible to man, and he talks about the flight of the buzzard and other sailors as a convincing demonstration. Now, basically what he says here is that you can look at these birds and understand that there's an instinctive knowledge that they have. Yeah, they have the machinery. They have the wings and you know their bodies, and we'll get into more of that a little bit later, but they have the bodies that are built for flying, and they have the wings, but they also have an instinctive knowledge. And what he says in this letter is that the knowledge is more important than the mechanics. And so he says that's what gives me hope that we'll be able to do this, because I mean we are smarter than birds. We have a reasoning capability. You know, we can match their knowledge. He says it's more more reasonably hope to equal, that man has more reasonable hope to equal birds and knowledge than to equal nature in the perfection of her machinery. And 100 years of flight design later, that's still true. You can't see that at all, but it says that all of the early pioneers of aviation were motivated by birds and flying insects. Now, before I go on about birds, I want to put this in a little bit of context for us. And the way I want to do this is in the context of a simple logical argument. And the first point is that design demands a designer. And this is something that no one's going to argue with. If you see a painting, then somebody painted it. There's a painter somewhere. If you read a poem, there's a poet. You know, someone wrote it. If you see an automobile moving down the freeway, you know there were engineers involved in putting that automobile together. Design demands a designer. Now, the point of departure is this idea that the universe shows evidence of design. That's where you're going to get a lot of argument from Darwinists and evolutionists. And that's kind of what we want to, I think we're focusing on this week, is hitting that box and saying, yes, the universe does show evidence of design. And the reason that we feel that is so important is because if you accept these two premises, and remember, no one's going to argue with the first one that I know of, design demands a designer, and the universe shows evidence of design, then the only conclusion you can come to is that the universe was designed by someone, by an intelligence. It didn't just happen. It didn't just appear or happen accidentally. Paul sort of hits on this idea in the book of Romans, first chapter, verses 18 through 22. He talks about the invisible attributes of God being clearly seen in the things that are made. Now, what are invisible attributes? You know, there are certain attributes about us, our hair color, eye color, aesthetic qualities that are visible attributes. But then we have invisible attributes like knowledge, intelligence, compassion, different things that people may not know about us unless they know us real well or they've seen us demonstrate these things through our activities. So Paul is saying these invisible attributes of God, God's power, internal power, his creativity perhaps, his wisdom, his intellect, are visible, are manifest in the things that are made, in the things that we see. So Paul certainly follows this idea there in the book of Romans. So again, like I said, we want to focus on that middle block and talk about, okay, the universe does show evidence of design. And as you heard, my area of expertise is aerospace engineering. So my focus is on flight. And so that's what we'll be talking about this evening. Before I go further, since irreducible complexity is a phrase that I'm going to use, I want to make sure that we understand what we're talking about. The formal definition is here, a single system which is composed of several interacting parts that contribute to the basic function. You take away any of those parts and then the function ceases to, the system ceases to fulfill that function. You have a bunch of pieces to a machine and it's doing a job and you pull one piece out and it doesn't do the job anymore. That's irreducible complexity. And that's an important idea in what we're talking about here. For instance, going back to birds, if we look at something as simple as the feather, we see an example of irreducible complexity at what I would call the component level, because the feather, a single feather is clearly just one component, small component of a bird that gives it the capability of flight. And we'll talk about more as we go along here. Feather is an amazing structure. There's nothing like it in nature. And feathers are unique to birds. Only birds have feathers, and feathers themselves are unique structures. We use the expression light as a feather. Well, feathers are obviously very light, but they're also very strong. Now, you could pick up a feather and break it very easily yourself, but in terms of strength to weight, how much force it takes you to break the feather compared to the weight of the feather is the strongest structure that you'll find on Earth, natural or man-made, or among the strongest strength to weight structures that you'll find on Earth. Feather also has some amazing qualities. You can see on the picture, the feather's a little bit ruffled there. When a feather's smooth and straight, on the frills, it has little hooks and barbules that combine together to, that keep allow the feather to keep its shape. And that's important, extremely important for flight, because the feather has to keep its shape in order for the wing of a bird to keep its aerodynamic properties. And those frills have to stay in line in order for that to happen. And they also help to smooth out the airflow, which makes it much easier for the bird to fly. This is a chart that shows how some people think that feathers came to be, how feathers evolved. And there are a couple of different theories here. You can see the pictures up here differ from the pictures down here a little bit. And I don't want to go into this in any painful detail. But the important part is you look at that chart, and let's say you saw it in a science book. It looks pretty scientific. It looks like someone that really knew what they were talking about spent a lot of time putting these together. And look at all the names listed along the side here. These all refer to different publications in which some of these evolutionary theories for feathers are discussed. Now, if we take a look at what one ornithologist evolutionist says, and I have a copy of the book right here, Alan Fiducia, or Fiducia, I don't speak Italian, so I know I'm murdering his name, but he says in this book that, again, feathers are unique to birds. No known structure intermediate between scales and feathers has been identified. Now, think about that for a second. And I put another copy of the chart here that shows in these theories what the intermediate steps are that they believe are between scales and feathers. Fiducia says, no known structure intermediate between scales and feathers has been identified. In the fossil record, they've never found anything intermediate between a scale and a feather that they could identify as an intermediate stage between a scale and a feather. That seems like a lot of work to me for something that's essentially imaginary, because there's no scientific evidence for anything on this chart. All it is okay, if we want to look at scales evolving to feathers, how would it happen? And this is a bunch of evolutionary scientists who decided, and that's why there are several different theories, because you know clearly they have no evidence to base it on. But this is how they think it would look. But look at what Fiducia goes on to say. Nevertheless, it has generally been accepted that feathers are derived directly from reptilian scales, with models provided by Matterson and Regal, and that's several of the names that you see on the chart there. Feathers are widely appreciated to be unique at the molecular level. So it should be evident, he says, that in an evolutionary sense, it follows that an important event occurred at the molecular level. Okay, we don't have any fossil records that physically show transition from scales to feathers. So it should be evident, he says, that something happened at a molecular level. And the supposition there is that it changed very quickly, that there was a lot of underlying change that didn't show up in the fossil record, and then it happened very quickly. Now, why should that be evident without evidence? Well, he gives the answer right there. In an evolutionary sense, we want to believe evolution, so we need a theory for how feathers came to be, for how feathers evolved, and that's why it should be evident to us that this is what happened. So we see how tenuous the theories of evolution can be. Now they feel like they have a lot of fossil, you know, record in other areas. But clearly, in this, they built a theory on almost no observational evidence, and just a belief in evolution, essentially. But feathers aren't the only thing that we can talk about when we talk about birds. Feathers are, as I said, are an example of irreducible complexity, because if you changed anything about the feather, it wouldn't function in the sense of allowing a bird to fly in the way that it does now. But we can also look at a bird's bone structure. Bird's bones are mostly hollow, which make it light enough to fly, but yet they're still strong enough. They're specially configured, especially this keel bone on the front here, to hold the flight muscles. And speaking of the muscles, the musculature of the bird is very specialized. The flight muscle in particular is a unique feature among all animals. It's a single muscle that wraps around a bone, which allows the bird to do both flapping motions with a single muscle. Now, that's a huge weight savings in terms of how the bird works, which is very critical because muscle is the heaviest tissue in a biological organism. So the less muscle that a bird has to have, the more flight worthy it's going to be. Then there's also the respiratory system, which is another thing that is unique to birds. No other animal has a respiratory system like a bird. It's air sacs. Instead of just having two lungs like we do, it's got air sacs distributed all over its body so that the weight of the air coming in can be spread out so that the bird stays balanced when it's flying. Sort of like in our aircraft, we put the fuel tanks in the wings so that the weight of the fuel is spread out so that it's not centralized to throw the aircraft off balance. So a bird has these features, and its respiratory system is also one way. It doesn't breathe in and breathe out as we do. It all goes through in one direction, which breathing out doesn't seem like it could create a lot of force, but for a bird in flight, breathing out could actually destabilize it in flight. So very specialized respiratory system, muscular system, and bone structure. Now, when we talk about irreducible complexity, what we can see here is that there are a number of things that go into making a bird flight worthy, to giving a bird the capability of flight. And this is all just on a physical level, just the biomechanical part of it. But if you take out one of these, it's going to be at most more difficult for a bird to fly, if possible at all. If you take out a couple of them, you know, birds can't fly at all. What does this mean from an evolutionary sense? Evolution or natural selection is a blind, undirected process. Now, we're not saying that all of these systems had to just suddenly appear simultaneously, but remember, evolution is built on very small changes. The idea is built on very small changes that build up to bigger changes over time. So in order for the bird to have all of these qualities, a lot of those smaller changes had to be happening more or less simultaneously. That's not a characteristic of natural selection, to be able to plan for a capability. So the probability that something like this could happen is so small that it's essentially zero. And in fact, going back to Fiducia, it's interesting that even when he's talking about bird evolution, he can't help but use language like, in order for flight to be possible, flight architecture was invented early on. Inventing is not something that happens accidentally. He talks about, he says that that flight is biomechanically and physiologically the most restrictive vertebrate locomotor adaptation. In other words, it's the most restrictive way to get around that you see in animals. Permitting little latitude for new designs. He uses the word design. Feathers are a near-perfect aerodynamic design, he says. Feathers with their almost magical structural complexity. Now, when an evolutionist uses a term like magical, what they're saying is we don't understand it. We don't know how this came to be. Through natural selection, the size and shape of wings have been optimized to minimize the energy required to fly. None of these kinds of things happen accidentally. And so the point that I'm making here is that even when an evolutionist talks about evolution, when he's talking about birds and flight, he just can't avoid using language like design. Now, what someone like Richard Dawkins would say is that the appearance of design in nature is illusion. He says here, natural selection can produce an uncanny illusion of design. An engineer would be hard put to decide whether a bird or a plane was more aerodynamically elegant. Let me stop there for a second, because I am an engineer and he's not. An engineer would be hard put to decide whether a bird or a plane was more aerodynamically elegant. There's no contest. The bird wins. There's no airplane that can come close to the kinds of flight maneuvers that a bird can perform. So powerful is the illusion of design. It took humanity until the mid-19th century to realize that it is an illusion. In other words, up until the mid-19th century, we believed all this was created. It took us until then to realize that all that design stuff, that was just an illusion. Now, in this book that I'm quoting here, Dawkins doesn't explain why that's true, how natural selection can truly produce the illusion of design. He just says that it's true, and that anything that we see that looks like design in nature is illusion. I disagree. Now, we're talking about the physical characteristics of birds, but there's more than just the physical characteristics of a bird that give it the capabilities to perform some of the flight maneuvers that it does. One of the most amazing things, and I don't know if you've ever seen this, I've been on a lake before and watched a blue heron swoop down and pick a fish out of the water. It's an amazing thing to watch. How would they learn to do that? I mean, think about, in an evolutionary sense, a lizard sprouting wings and you know, growing flight muscles and everything else. And all of a sudden, you know, he finds himself, he's an eagle. How do you even know how to do something like this? My area especially is actually control design. So I understand the kind of flight controls which, if we were going to design an aircraft to do something like this, the kind of flight control system that it would have to have. Number one, we can't do this, at least not yet, not with an airplane. And we're not even close. But if you just look at some of the different poses of the bird in some of these pictures, for instance, in the bottom right corner there, as the eagle is soaring close to the water, and he's already grabbed the fish. So what that's going to do, it adds more weight, so it's going to immediately slow him down. And he's got his wings, it sort of looks like he's making a parachute. Well, that's because at lower speeds, he has to produce more lift to stay in flight. Now, once he clears the water enough, you know, then he can flap a few times and gain some more speed. But until he gets a little bit of altitude, he has to do that in order to, you know, maintain his altitude above the water. When they're approaching the water, you look at the top left corner. The bird is very pointed. You know, actually, initially they'll dive with their feet back to gain speed. Then they go into that configuration, which is still fairly streamlined, so they don't slow down. They've got to get the fish, right? And fish are pretty fast. So he's got to build up some speed, and he's got to hit that fish pretty quick. So he's still able to maintain a lot of speed going into the water right there. But if you look at his wings, it sort of looks like the twin tails of an F-18. The way that he's got them in that V configuration allows him to keep lateral stability. If he didn't do that, you know, if he just did his wings back like that, he would probably roll out of control. So he's, you know, he's maintaining flight stability there. and then, you know, right after that, of course, he grabs the fish. And then in this case, this bird has a foot configuration that allows it to actually push off of the water a little bit. So then he's using his wings to generate some thrust there. Now, if you think about a bird, again, trying to do something like this for the very first time, and if we believe they evolved, then that had to have happened at some point, because lizards don't know how to do this. So if a lizard's going to evolve into a bird, he's got to learn to do this somewhere along the way. Evolution is usually more of a trial and error process. This doesn't admit a lot of trial and error. These birds approach the water at I don't know, 35 to 50 miles per hour. If they mess up, they're probably not going to get another shot at it. That water, as you know, because of the surface tension, they say as hard as concrete. I think Mythbusters kind of laid that to rest, but it's still pretty hard. You know, if you hit the surface of water going pretty fast, it's still pretty hard. If the bird doesn't drown, he's likely to break his neck. Remember, the bones of a bird are hollow so that it can be light enough to fly, but that also makes their bones a little bit weaker than other vertebrates. Or it could break a wing. And in the wild, a broken wing essentially makes a bird easy prey. So the idea that a bird could somehow learn to do this is very antithetical. God tells Job in Job 39:26, or ask Job, does the hawk take flight by your wisdom and spread his wings toward the south? Does the eagle soar at your command and build his nest on high? The inspired writer of the Bible clearly indicates knowledge that a bird has to have some wisdom, has to have some, we would call it instinct, has to have some built-in instinct. It has to have a flight computer that's pre-programmed to allow it to do stuff like this. A bird doesn't have the capability to do that programming. As humans, we can. You know, we can reason. We can watch birds and we could say, well, you know, I can build this wind tunnel and learn how to make wings and, you know, like the Wright brothers, eventually learn how to fly. Birds don't have that intellect capability to be able to do that. So this type of thing has to be instinctual for them. But things don't get any easier for evolutionists, because as hard as it is for them to describe how flight capability might have evolved in birds, birds are not the only flying creatures. You've got flying insects, bats, and we know from the fossil record, one thing we do know from the fossil record is that at one time there were flying reptiles. Now, no evolutionist is going to try to tell you that there's kind of any evolutionary relationship between these types of creatures. So what does that mean? That means flight had to evolve independently at least four different times. Because there's no relationship. You know, insects didn't evolve into birds. Flying insects didn't evolve into birds. Flying insects didn't evolve into bats. No one has even suggested that flying reptiles evolved into birds. So there's no interrelationship. So these are different systems. So from a technical standpoint, the definition of irreducible complexity doesn't apply. But you could almost call this irreducible complexity on a system of systems level, because we're talking about the same capability. We're talking about flight, but yet it had to evolve independently at least four different times. So going back to our argument then, I think that, again, you know, no one's going to disagree with that. I think that the universe does show evidence of design, and I don't believe or don't agree that it's an illusion. And I'll be happy to talk with anyone further that wants to discuss that. So again, the obvious conclusion is the universe was designed. Now that's especially important to us as Christians, because the Bible is the only book associated with a major world religion that talks about design. It's actually the only book associated with a world religion that gives a detailed account of creation. Now, the other books that we can talk about, you know, the Book of Mormon, the Quran, they talk about creation, but they don't give the detailed day-by-day account that we find in the Bible. But the Bible is also the book that talks about design. If we look at the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 10, verse 12, he has made the earth by his power, he has established the world by his wisdom, and has stretched out the heavens by his discretion. Now, if you look at the first statement, he's made the earth by his power, that's a statement of God's creative power. That says God has the resources to do this. If you look at the last statement, he stretched out the heavens by his discretion. What does discretion mean? It means he had options. He had different ways that, you know, potentially that he could do it. He used his discretion, and he used a particular process, and he created the heavens. So if he has discretion and he has to choose between options, what does that lead to? Well, if you look at the middle statement, he has established or planned out the world by his wisdom, by his intellect. That's design. So Jeremiah there talks about God's creative power, that he used a process, but he also talks about design, that God's wisdom played into creation. Again, in Job, God asked Job, do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? This is a very interesting verse of scripture because the idea that the universe possessed natural laws that regulated it didn't really come into existence until like the 17th or 18th century. Now, Job was written well before that. And here he talks about the ordinances of heavens. What's another name for a word for ordinances? Laws or regulations. So whoever was the inspired writer of the book of Job knew that the universe was regulated. He mentions the word dominion, that the universe was controlled by laws or ordinances millennia before scientists figured it out. That is an element of design. These kind of regulatory laws or regulatory guidelines show evidence of design. So not only do we accept that the universe has a designer, but because the Bible is the only book that talks about design, and we firmly believe the universe shows evidence of design, we can say emphatically that the universe was designed by the God of the Bible. And I really appreciate your presence here this evening. I appreciate your time and your attention. I'll be around afterward if you have any questions. I don't want to take any of Brandon's time, so we'll go ahead and quit there. Thank you very much.